Could I welcome you all here this evening for the final talk in our 2005-2006 series for the Howard League in Scotland. And I don't think I would need to introduce any of you to our speaker this evening, Professor Richard Sparks. And to continue with the football analogies that I promised earlier on, this is a home fixture for the Professor. And I'm sure you're all as intrigued as I am to hear what the trilemma of penal reform means, and I'll hand over to Richard.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. I'm quite intrigued myself because for the following reason. At the point at which I was asked originally by Jackie Toombs whether I would give this talk, it was some months ago anyway, and I'd only recently fetched up in Edinburgh, had a great many things on my mind, but a number of work, projects and ideas rumbling away. And I said, I'm going to give this talk on the trilemma of penal reform. And at the point which I said that, I knew exactly what I meant by it. Well, you must believe me. However, in the intervening number of months, it somehow kind of slipped away. That thought had evaporated, and I needed to spend quite a bit of time and effort reconstructing what on earth I might have meant by it. So, why trilemma of penal reform? I should just, and a number of other things worried me in the course of preparing this talk, like, is this too abstract? Is it not kind of concrete and topical enough? All of these things. But what I want to try to do, and in proposing this trilemma thing, what I would like us collectively to spend a little bit of time doing is a sort of attempt to roughly model some things that seem to me to have taken place in a number of Western penal systems, not just our own, but including those of the United Kingdom, in the last number of years. And that, therefore, in the nature of such models, we can either revise or extend or develop it in some way, but another thing that we can do is kind of flesh out the basic structure, if it seems to work, and attempt to apply it in one way or another. I should just mention, you know, at a point at which you're feeling kind of anxious about giving a certain talk and whether it's actually going to make any sense or not, what I always do is apply what some of you have heard me refer to before as the Hay Doctrine. Right? And the Hay Doctrine says, which derives from a period in which Will Hay and I were giving many talks together, and you're feeling very, very kind of anxious about it, is it doesn't last long. Okay, that's the Hay Doctrine. And the originator of the Hay Doctrine is here with us this evening. Thank you, Will. So why trilemma? But the original purpose of introducing this peculiar word is that I think there's something going on in the context of the sorts of fields of forces in which penal politics and the development of contemporary penal systems have been involved in the last couple of decades that is more complicated even than a dilemma. So I'm going to have to spend a few minutes at the beginning of this discussion saying something about what I understand by the, and I don't want to spend too much time on definitions, but a certain amount will be necessary, saying what I think a dilemma is, why the notion of a dilemma of penal reform is an important notion in terms of our historical understanding of the penal systems, and why I think that we can no longer operate with that terminology, if indeed anybody was doing. But the point in which the notion of a trilemma is trying to get at is that there's something going on which is in various ways poses difficult choices which are may not be capable of definitive resolutions. That there is a tension between priorities. Those priorities may not, any of them, be disposable, so the tension is permanent, or at least intractable or persistent, and unlikely to be readily solved just one way. And it's for something like this reason I will try to show that in our kind of society, penal systems are as contentious as increasingly involved in political debates and disputes and ideological controversies, and that tendency has increased over the last couple of decades. So we're dealing with an attempt to get at a condition of controversy and intractability, but one where, nevertheless and inevitably, certain kinds of choices and decisions must be made. So it's trying to get at the sorts of competing priorities that face those who are making those decisions. So what do we mean by dilemmas and trilemmas, and why are they interesting here? Well, luckily I managed to discard some of the more technical, there are technical philosophical senses of the idea of a dilemma or a trilemma, which we're not even going to think about, because they relate to all sorts of issues to do with the logical form of a syllogism and the contradiction between the major and the minor propositions, and the idea of the horns of a dilemma actually means requiring someone you're having an argument with to entertain contradictory propositions, essentially. But what I mean by a dilemma is what most of us mean if we're thinking clearly about it, which is a choice between courses of action where neither choice is really acceptable or desirable. That choosing one way puts you in the position of accepting something undesirable from the other side. Right? So there is imperfect, a necessarily imperfect and intractable decision. But not just a difficult choice. It's not just, you know, shall I have the meat or the fish, or shall I wear the grey or the brown, or whatever it is. It is a choice between problematic things, is what I think this is directing our attention to. So I think this little quote that I've abstracted from the University of Nebraska Medical Center, I think there's something pleasantly North American about the last line, that this discourages real problem solving. So real problem solving is something that we could in principle be doing, but we do confront dilemmas. So now, there are all kinds of uses of the idea of a dilemma. Here are some. It may not be necessary to go into them. An ethical dilemma means trying to solve an ethical problem using non-ethical or extra-ethical materials, like shall I take this or that decision, notwithstanding the fact that it might disrupt my career? Okay. The prisoner's dilemma is relatively familiar to people. It means two individuals who might have a collective interest, but they don't know enough about one another's motives to combine their or trust one another's decisions, so they wind up confounding their own objectives. A social dilemma means somebody taking advantage for their own interests of a certain kind of situation, such as not paying their income tax, when in fact they're not doing that would be great for everybody else's interests and indeed in the long term their own. So it's the so-called free rider problem. And a security dilemma, which is a bit more relevant to our immediate interests here, is the situation in international relations where two countries wind up going to war out of mutual fear of one another's motives when neither of them wished or intended to do so. So dilemmas are things which produce unexpected, unanticipated, perverse and undesirable outcomes, notwithstanding people's intentions. But there are many false dilemmas, things that appear to be proper dilemmas that aren't, such as the so-called fallacy of the excluded middle, which is where we say to our children, you know, do you want to do your homework or do you want to grow up to be a complete bum? Do you want to eat your dinner, or do you want all the starving children in Africa to die? that there are other possible choices, and you're setting up things which don't necessarily apply. I think that in the history of penal change, and in our current debates, indeed every time you switch on Radio 5 at 9 o'clock in the morning to listen to the phone-in, you are hearing the fallacy of the excluded middle constantly, that people are setting up unrealistic and inapplicable binary choices about whether punishment should be applied this way or that way, whether it should be hard or whether it should be soft, whether it should rehabilitate and reform or whether it should merely punish and deter. But people are setting up oppositions which can't be applied, but which nevertheless dominate much of our public discourse. And this is part of what I understand by the notion of a dilemma in the relation to prisons, punishment and penal reform. There's another pithier and I think helpful restatement of whatever a dilemma is from the philosophy departments at Princeton University, so it must be right, that a dilemma is a state of uncertainty or perplexity requiring a choice between unfavourable options. Now, I mention this for a further reason, which is that I wanted to make some kind of homage to a really, really important but latterly extremely neglected book by Herman Mannheim called The Dilemma of Penal Reform. And The Dilemma of Penal Reform was a series of public lectures that Mannheim gave at the LSE in 1939. So he's writing on the very brink of the outbreak of war with the country from which he fled 5 or 6 years previously. Mannheim, I think we should remember, although a latterly, largely forgotten and unread character, was incredibly important to the development of criminology and indeed penal reform activity in the United Kingdom. Let's remind ourselves of one or two things about him. He was, for example, amongst other things, the vice president of the Howard League, that he was the effective founder of the British Society of Criminology and its predecessor body, which rejoiced in the name of something, yes, the the Scientific Group for the Discussion of Delinquency Problems. he was the author of many other books, including Social Aspects of Crime in England Between the Wars, Juvenile Delinquency in an English Middletown, Comparative Criminology. No, these are, to me, quite important works, but nevertheless ones which I don't think you would find very many stamps in the library for you to go and get them out. And The Dilemma of Penal Reform is like that. And I think it's very, very unjust that, you know, Mannheim is so largely forgotten when that Chancellor Radinovich is so well remembered for his far greater powers of self-promotion. Now, Mannheim, in The Dilemma of Penal Reform, the dilemma refers primarily, in his view, to the competing claims set up between what he saw at that point as being the two kind of great motivators of penal policy, namely deterrence and rehabilitation. And here's the dilemma as he understood it. On the one hand, deterrence and all systems of punishment to that point, he argued, rested to a greater or lesser extent on something called the principle of less eligibility, where less eligibility means this deep-seated sense that it's immoral and irrational and unacceptable if people undergoing any form of punishment and classically imprisonment in any way experience conditions which are preferable either to those which they might have experienced outside or which a similarly situated person, and overwhelmingly in the history of penal systems that means a very poor person, might have experienced were they not undergoing punishment. So less eligibility was massively influential in the 19th century. For example, in the history of transportation, one of the reasons, amongst many others, why transportation fell into discredit and ceased to be used was that too many stories came home from the 1820s onwards saying, we're making good in Australia. You know, we've served our time in the colony and we've become wealthy, or we're establishing ourselves as farmers. Come out and join us. From that point on, too many respectable people thought, well, this transportation thing isn't working anymore. It's not sufficiently feared. It's not sufficiently terrible. It might be the case that those to whom we apply it wind up having a good life, and that would be unacceptable. And similarly, throughout the for obvious reasons, as economic conditions changed in the course of the 19th century, especially in periods of downturn, so that the conditions of the working, or rather the non-working poor, primarily in the ever-growing cities of London and Manchester and Glasgow, were pushed down to new levels of dreadfulness, so prison conditions had to be adapted downwards as well, in order that they not that prisons be, as one of the prison commissioners of the period put it, be sufficiently dreaded. Hence the application of the move at certain points in the 19th century from productive prison labour to unproductive and purely penal use of the crank and other instruments, and so on and so forth. So our common sense idea that Mannheim is saying is central to most of our ideas of punishment depend to one degree or another, to a greater or lesser extent, in a highly variable manner, on a principle of less eligibility. Whereas, he says, rehabilitation, which he sees as being the other great animating force, especially in the 20th century, around the development of prison prisons, absolutely, in his view, requires that less eligibility be abandoned. In that, one's chances, in his opinion, of actually doing anything effective in the way of rehabilitating offenders meant that you ceased to think in those terms. You thought, well, it might work. This might operate. This might apply. But endlessly, reform and rehabilitative projects of various kinds have tended to founder, amongst other reasons, their kind of confrontation or encounter with less eligibility problems. So you think of examples of troubled young people being sent on sailing ships, which are thought to develop their character and social skills and so on and so forth, creating vastly disproportionate controversy in the press. Why? Because it offends something, A, about a basic aspect of many people's common sense of justice, and on the other hand as well, because it appears to be perverse from the point of view of deterrence. In other words, from Mannheim's point of view, these things are a genuine contradiction between which it is impossible to resolve unless you abandon the idea of deterrence, which is what he is advocating in that work. Okay. Unless we think that less eligibility has simply gone away, it doesn't take very long for things to crop up where a comparison is drawn between people in prison, people in hospital, whether people in the prison have too much ready access to pay television vis-a-vis the people in hospital who are paying less for it, and so on and so forth. In other words, it's permanent. Less eligibility is not something that has been eradicated, or which has gone from our consciousness. But anyway, this is about one kind of dilemma that shapes or constrains the sorts of things that it is possible to do or do with penal practices. And there's Herman Mannheim, who I've just been saying all these nice things about because I admire him. So a trilemma, okay, this is the scary first definition of trilemma, which is this thing in logic which we will forget about, which relates to the the relationship between the major and minor premises of syllogism, whatever those are, but actually, for our purposes, means a state of things in which it is difficult to determine which of three courses of action to pursue. Okay, so we've kind of, trilemma means lots of things, I discovered in my kind of little survey of the internet the last week or so. Obviously it means a very kind of arcane and complicated board game. It means the name of a jazz, blues and rock combo from Ross on Wye, which is a nice one. However, a trilemma for this purpose is similar to a dilemma, but kind of harder, in that there are more than just these two things going on. I'm saying trilemma, suggesting that there are three, and I am going to mention three as we go through. But it could work for more possibilities, it seems to me, that what we are talking about is the difficulty of choice between equally undesirable, or conversely, equally desirable possibilities, and the possibility that, you know, there is a necessity of choice, but in every choosing, something be given up. So it might be possible sometimes to resolve your dilemma, or as Mannheim suggests, you resolve your dilemma between deterrence and rehabilitation in favour of rehabilitation, he says. Or you resolve your choice definitively one way or another, but more commonly, what we are left with is the fact that we are struggling with competing priorities, or competing dangers, or competing goods. So, now I suggested that we move from thinking about dilemmas to moving to think about trilemmas for the following reasons. One, I think that although I deeply admire Mannheim's work in general, and that book in particular, and wish more people read it, and I just had the very good idea of setting it for the students next year and so on, the idea that that it is possible for us to think too much in terms of opposites, in terms of binary choices, in terms of either this or that in this field, that the balance metaphor, that we have to balance on the one hand this and on the other hand the other, can be distracting and problematic, it seems to me. And certainly, from the point of view of the way in which criminologists write, it can mean that criminologists are often writing in a way that is simpler, that is oversimplified in respect of the actual choices that practitioners and policymakers have to exercise, because they are saying there is this and there is that, there is tough, there is tender, there is lenient, there is harsh, there is a choice between values or practicality, and people working in those fields, in those systems, know that there's more going on than that, there's more different priorities or more different claims on their attention, and that something, the excluded middle that we mentioned earlier, is being missed out. So, for example, too many people have written about the latter-day development of penal politics in relation to, for example, the so-called crisis of the rehabilitative ideal and all of its consequences since the 1970s, as if rehabilitation stopped, and that therefore what was going on was some other kind of battle in which it ceased to apply. But I think there are all kinds of grounds for thinking that some of those principles may have undergone extreme tribulation and difficulty, but in fact they didn't just cease to be part of the conversation, and indeed recurred, came back into focus in a way that it took an awfully long time for many of us academics to cotton on to. So that our tendency to think in terms of dilemmas or dualisms actually kind of falsifies what was really taking place, it seems to me. Even my friend, alumnus of this institution, somebody I very, very deeply admire and influenced me in all kinds of ways, David Garland, drew this very influential distinction a few years ago between what he called the criminologies of the self, i.e. the things that we do in penal practices that apply to people a bit like us when we do things that are a bit wayward or a bit problematic, but which we can be sort of drawn back into conformity by some sort of gentle pressure, and the criminologies of the other, which are the things that we apply to the marginal, the excluded, and people who are not at all like us, who can safely be treated in quite different ways. And it just, you know, it's too binary, I think, to describe in many ways what the actual field of forces with which we're dealing. So here's one attempted way out of some of these binary, dualistic, dilemma-style ways of thinking. Bottoms, in a very influential article written in 1995, said, well, actually, there are kind of four things at stake in the way in which our penal systems have mutated over recent history. These were, in his view, a conjoined emphasis that he called just desert stroke human rights, that is to say, the emphasis on proportionality in sentencing, in the aftermath of the crisis of the rehabilitative ideal, as being, you know, more appropriate, more predictable, more rights respecting than more instrumental objectives, combined at the same time coexisting with managerialism, i.e. management, thinking about the system ever more as a system and not just an interacting set of institutions, that is something that might be more managed, in which there might be more reference to performance indicators that are similar in kind to those that are applied in other kinds of institutions. So reducing, as it were, the distinctive specialness of the criminal justice system, making it rather more like other organisations, a strong and a kind of pervasive reference to something called community, both as an element in political rhetoric, but also as a site, the kind of place where certain sorts of interventions take place, and fourthly, what he called populist punitiveness, which is to say, what it says on the label, you know, the uses, the political uses of punishment in politics by political actors for benefit, claiming to take upon themselves, for more or less cynical reasons, the position of the people, to stand for the common person against the criminal for political effect. Now that seems to me to be quite a bit better than thinking about how penal systems have developed or might develop than dilemmas, if that by dilemmas we mean binary choices. But it's still just a list. Right? It doesn't say very much about the dynamic relationship between the elements of the list, or why there are those and only those. You know, why not just add to the list? What else might be going on? So it's not actually a model, it seems to me, of how the penal system has been influenced or might change. It's a list. But a good list. So, what I would like to do with this blank slide is try to propose a model that goes to some extent with my notion of a trilemma, that says there are three domains that I suspect are operative in contemporary societies in important ways, that constrain and direct the ways in which penal systems are used, the way in which they become political, the kinds of constraints that imposes on what we can do to them. which constitute what I am calling the trilemma. Okay, and these domains I'm calling politics, risks, and new social movements and sensibilities. Now, the politics means very much the same kinds of things as bottoms meant by populist punitiveness, but not necessarily only that. It means, as Garland has put it, that over the last 3 decades or so, the tone of debate in relation to penal politics and criminal justice has moved from cool to hot. What used to be a specialist area of discussion amongst professionals, or to some extent in terms of the composition of people in this room, it still is that, finally, has become something vehement and high profile and impassioned and dramatic and full of emotion, of various rather intense kinds, that those conditions place a sort of standing temptation on political actors to want to emote for effect alongside the common person with their troubles and their fears and their anger and their vexation, and to demonstrate their strength and will and capacity, and to seek to mobilise people perhaps against a mutually identified enemy or opponent, and in so doing to buttress their legitimacy as political actors. And you can see that at certain moments of threat, or conversely of political opportunity, this is something which can be manipulated to effect. And that's the politics part, in the old-fashioned sense of the politics of the state, the nation-state, the Leviathan, the thing that's supposed to be claiming to provide us with our security. At the same time, in reality, the actual operation of penal systems, like most other modern organisations, is really focused, to a very large extent, on trying to cope with various kinds of risk, trying to predict what nasty things might happen, trying to make assessments, trying to act in the most rational possible way on the available information, trying to anticipate, trying to contain, but doing that, arguably, in ways that are increasingly explicit and distinctive, and which maybe gradually kind of ease out or nudge aside many of the more traditional aims and justifications and purposes of criminal justice with which they sometimes conflict. So if we are asked to think increasingly about managing offenders, or about the process of criminal justice as the management of offenders and not simply the doing of proportionate justice, then we should acknowledge that this is in tension with at least some of the traditional aims of the system. And there are certainly some versions of these arguments which see the development of the discourses around risk as in some ways more or less sinister or worrying, for those kinds of reasons to do with their rather value-free pragmatism and so on and so forth. So there's a tension there. But what much of the literature does, I think, is stop at this point, and in so doing it tells a very depressing and disabling story that says on the one hand there is a highly emotive form of politics, on the other hand there is risk management. That's it. That's all there is. And it's very, very bad. It's very bad. It's bad analysis, and it's kind of problematic politics, I think, because it is so grim, but it's posing, I suspect, at least in part, an unnecessary dilemma, which is also, you know, committing various kinds of fallacy of the excluded middle. And amongst the things which it is potentially excluding are the presence in that conversation of an at least nominally universalising discourse of human rights, some different ideas of about what we should do with the notion of victims and victimisation. Now, this figures, as I'll suggest further in a minute, in all three of these boxes in different ways. On this, on the politics, the old politics side, victims might be something whose needs, interests, emotions and so on are more or less exploited in the political process. That they are used in kind of demotic ways, used to justify the harsher treatment of offenders, used to claimed in aid by political actors to buttress arguments for ever greater security provision and the toughening of sentences and other kinds of provisions and so on. They figure in risk assessment as something which crucially must be prevented or impeded. That, you know, the actors in many kinds of organisations are under all sorts of pressure to prevent, forestall possible victimisation against vulnerable people, especially children and women and other categories of victim. But they also figure, you know, in at least some ways of thinking about new social movements as a way in which we might develop our understanding of crime problems to take in new categories of harm, to take in formerly invisible groups of persons, to think about distant others outside our immediate environment, to think about future generations in relation, for example, to environmental harm. So there's actually much more that might be said about the politics of victimisation than that this is just part of a reactionary political rhetoric. And at the same time, there's all sorts of other discourses, more in some places than in others, I suspect somewhat more in Scotland than in England currently, around questions of inclusion, reinsertion into various forms of law-abiding possibility about new practices such as restorative justice and so on. Now, I think it is more helpful to think about these three domains than it is to think about two, and it is helpful to think about them as somewhat independent things that influence and interact with each other, but which, at certain points, can readily, and it is very often this one, yes, I had help, Jackie.
I know it's
yes,
wrong.
I did. That can readily overwhelm the others by virtue of a particular moment of threat or a particular moment of opportunity in which a certain actor or point of view tries to seize that moment for themselves and their own aggrandisement or power. Similarly, there is a strong argument in much of the literature that, you know, risk management, although backstage, although in many ways a kind of quiet and unobtrusive thing, tends to displace other objectives and other practices to their detriment, tends to overwhelm them, to trump, and so on. And whether that is actually something that's taking place or whether it is an exaggeration within the literature is something that we need to think through and work out. I'm suggesting that there has certainly been an expansion of the domain of politics, but that there's also been a moving together of these formerly distinct domains in such a way that they cross and hybridise and complicate each other, and that what we actually do is, I keep pointing at the screen so you can see what I'm doing. What they actually do is we live in here somewhere, at the kind of meeting point of these three difficult things, and that is the trilemma as I am trying to formulate it. So what are the conclusions? Well, I think that there are these three intersecting domains, that all kinds of things might be done far better to specify and flesh out what they are, but I think that they're all there, I think they're all important, and that they do mutually influence and intersect with each other, and that they therefore stand in a long-standing, persistent, and persistently tense relationship, which to some greater or lesser extent describes the field of forces in which all of us who are sort of thinking about or trying to negotiate our way around the contemporary politics of the criminal justice system are involved. I think those things, and one of the reasons why the politics bubble sometimes blows up and swallows up the others, is that that relationship can be highly complicated by the development or the emergence of new sources of insecurity, as well as new technical possibilities that might be claimed in aid to address them. So there's a kind of constant dialectic of between the identification of new problems and the suggestion of new solutions towards them, and that's where we're at with identity cards and DNA databases and identity theft and all those sorts of problems. I think that, as I've already suggested, in various ways, victimhood, victims and victimisation, and the state of the moral standing of victims participate in all three of those domains, and is to that extent a highly central issue and way of thinking about any of them that we can't really get away from, nor should we try. But that in different ways, all three of those areas bear upon politics in this sense, and that they all go to questions about the legitimacy of systems, of nation states ultimately, and of justice systems, and of the actors within them. Why? Well, partly because in relation to politics, it's about whether one adequately voices and describes and names and kind of takes possession politically of the issue, and somehow shows that one is sufficiently responsive to it, that one understands the needs and interests of the common person, and that, you know, as the actor responsible, or actors responsible within state agencies or other supervisory systems, you have the capacity to deal with these issues as they are presented to you. In relation to risk management and the kind of professional operation of many of these systems, the question is whether we are competent, whether the system is sufficiently geared to do its job of anticipating and preventing and forestalling, and that is very controversial whenever that fails, so that any kind of failure or omission becomes potentially scandalous. And the more that the risk management aspect of the three intersecting domains and the politics one intersects, the more potentially scandalous every failure of risk management becomes. But that also, finally, I think it's also true to, it's at least worth suggesting that as far as the new sensibilities and social movements are concerned, there are many people who are also seeking some kind of responsiveness or innovation or signs of life from within our systems, which offer new possibilities or new alternative solutions, and that's worth thinking about from the point of view of legitimacy as well. Now, the question I'm not going to attempt to address is whether any of that general discussion, don't have time to address it, hopefully, really applies in Scotland in any kind of different way than anywhere else. Is it, in a sense, if the model is pitched at a certain level of abstraction, it says, well, it applies to some extent everywhere and nowhere kind of exactly. The question, I suppose, is how you would tailor or customise or re-specify any of that so that it actually gave an account of the state of the dialogue, the debate, the field of forces as they apply in Scotland, but I think at least that there are reasons for attempting that, because there might be, and I haven't been here long enough to give you a definitive answer on this, but I'm thinking hard about it and will be attempting to formulate one, for thinking that that answer in relation to Scotland is, in certain important respects, not the same, not identical, anyway, with that that you would have to give for England and Wales, let alone any of the states of the United States, let alone the United States, or indeed not identical with that of any other European country either. That might go equally for all of those other places, but I think that there are distinctive contours and configurations within that general state of the trilemma which give us some grounds for thinking in new and interesting ways about possibilities for criminal justice in Scotland, on which point I know that I'm supposed to come up with something now to go in the next manifesto for the next elections, yeah, right? Okay. And so I've got two. And they are something like this. They're not, don't no, look too expectant. This is not going to be particularly wonderful or fantastic. But in relation to that question about distinctiveness, then, one thing I would like to say at this point is, it is possible for Scotland to sustain a focus when it thinks about risk management and offender management on inequality and on exclusion and on the community context of offending and resettlement in a way that has been substantially eroded in England, and that I would like to recommend that the next party in government in Scotland do its very best to maintain that focus on inequality and exclusion and on the community context of offender management and reintegration, and not to over-individualise its analysis of problems of risk and reoffending, because those seem to me to be very valuable things about the Scottish tradition in criminal justice policy, and ones that are worth hanging on to. And that secondly, if, as I would recommend, the next governing party in Scotland to continue to found its policy on the best available research evidence and to insulate criminal justice decisions as far as possible from the white heat of party politics, that chance, maybe. There we are. That's all I have to say.